And anyone else?
Hello, this is Ken.
Yay.
Hi, Ed.
Just who I needed on this call.
Yeah, how are you?
Oh, I'm just confused.
How are you? Well, you shouldn't be confused.
I am confused. You know, it's the story of my life. Where were you? You were out of town, right?
Yeah, I still am. I'm in Chicago.
Oh.
Sitting in O'Hare. No, it's a little, well, it's a little bit, it's a little bit muggy. I think it, I can conceive of a thunderstorm sometime before my plane leaves.
What time's your plane?
It's at 5:55, so that's actually almost 3 hours. So, so I'm sitting here in the airport, anticipating with great bated breath, this call.
Okay.
Got here.
Well, it's going to be an exciting.
How was St. Petersburg?
Fantastic.
Was it? Oh, that's good.
And then I went to Nizhny Novgorod.
Where's that?
That was even better.
That's great.
So
really?
I just have to find my agenda here, and then we can get going.
Okay.
Yeah. Hello?
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 We're here.
Wendy's here now.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Phil and Wendy.
Hi, Phil.
I can.
How are you both?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm just great.
Other than sitting in an airport.
Right.
Good.
Well, yeah. I can think of sitting in worse places.
All right. Well, we can get going because I know Tatiana's not going to be do you know anything about Tina being on today or not?
Yeah, I think I'm sure Tina's going to be on today.
Okay. And Elizabeth Sal, I think, is in Europe, so at least that's what I heard. So I don't know if she's going to be on or if Catherine Nard's going to be on.
Mm-hmm.
But
Ken, it looks like I went to Weather Radar.
Yes.
I think you're okay. The storms are south of you and moving directly east.
Oh, well, you made my 3 o'clock hour. That's wonderful. Thanks, Ken.
You're welcome.
Very much. Very, very much. That's great.
All right. So, oh, here's someone else.
Bill Barnett from Indiana.
Hey, Bill. Well, I think we had a reasonable month in terms of getting data collected and even in some cases into the central repository. There were a few things that I wanted to talk about because they're the things I'm most confused about right now in my life. And I'm glad that Ken's there because it has to do to palpebral fissure size. And I'm just going to give an example, and I think that this is must be absolutely totally confusing for the entire field. But if you measure palpebral fissure size in a 12-year-old male, and then look at the fifth percentile, if you use the chart from Hall, that child would have a palpebral fissure size of 26.8 millimeters. If you use the chart from Thomas, that child would have palpebral fissure sizes of 24 millimeters. If you use our charts, it would have 23.5 millimeters. If you use the Claren charts, it would have 24.5 millimeters. And if he was black and you use the IASUB charts, it would be 35 millimeters.
35?
So, yeah, which is incredible.
That's a 12-year-old at what percentile?
For the IASUB data, he just presented.
Well, no.
That's for a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's at the 50th percentile?
At the fifth percentile.
Fifth percentile, okay.
Yeah. And the IASUB ones were for black and Hispanic children, and he doesn't really provide curves. He just tells you that between 6 and 15 years of age, it's around 33 millimeters. So now
these were blacks living where? At
the IS-1 New York.
New York, okay. So they're U.S. They're
right.
They're African and Caribbean American kids.
Right.
Some of them were Dominican. Some of them were
right.
African.
He reports the differences between black and Hispanic. And the paper was in response to, your measurements. Because of the norms that were available at the time were only for whites, and they were working in a predominantly black population, and they wanted to see if there were differences. And sure enough, there are differences. And people knew that for quite some time, that blacks have slightly larger pepibral fissure sizes than do whites.
Right.
I hope that my confusion can relate, since a difference of 1 millimeter can really drop a child one whole standard deviation, depending upon the age.
Right.
That, and the reason that this came up was trying to look at the similarities between the 3D facial image measurements and the clinical measurements. When they didn't work out, when they weren't really that concordant, it usually had to do with the palpebral fissure measurement and the percentiles assigned to it. And so we started to look at this, and then as most of you know, Susan Astley looks at the third centile, but the chart she's using, the third centile is like the 20th percentile of the Thomas chart and the chart 13 that we use. So it's more liberal than she would expect you to believe based on her third centile.
It's also produced from photographs, is it not?
Pardon?
It's also produced from 2D photographs.
No, even when they measured them, the chart that she uses, Hall, was done on real live people.
Did you say the Hall? The second ago you said she used the Thompson. Which one did she use?
She uses the Hall.
Okay.
So that's my confusion in life for right now. And given that palpebral fissure size is such a important diagnostic indication of FAS, it just seems that someone needs to, and I can't believe that the data may not already be out there, but that better norms are not available. Most of these norms all relate to the same subjects that were collected back in 1920 or 30. With the addition of the neonatal and preterm infants that Ken Jones offered to the Thomas chart. And even the Thomas chart differs from the chart we're using, at least after age 6, by half a millimeter, or around that. But a half a millimeter on palpebral fissure length is a reasonable size. So that's just my thought for the day, is that we need to somehow get better measurements of palpebral fissure and get some reasonable norms, or kids are just going to get misclassified all the time.
Well, I think there are two things that I'd like to mention, not being a dysmorphologist and not doing the measurements. One is that there is tremendous variation from one community to the next, one ethnic group to the next. That's why we always collect control groups, so that we have local anthropometric and community norms. Two is not everybody, when they're doing the clinical measurements, does them the same way. And I've watched our team since 1997 work very hard at standardizing exactly where on the cheek and in what plane they hold the ruler, because there can be easily 1 to 2 millimeters difference if they don't put the ruler on the same flat plane. I think a lot of your variance comes from those two factors.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what Ken says. But what I've done is to It looks like papabral fissures are measured by ophthalmologists prescribing contact lenses. Unfortunately, they usually don't pay great attention to the length. They normally pay more attention to the width. But I'm trying to find out.
You mean vertical? You mean the vertical? Okay.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find out if there's any high-tech way that that people who are getting fitted for contact lenses get their papabral fissure and length and width measured.
Ed.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to sort of in second to a certain extent what Phil's saying, not completely what Phil's saying, but the fact of the matter is that a 1 millimeter difference between two people is well within what we consider the range of measurement error. So if we can get within 1 millimeter of each other, we feel pretty darn good. Now, that is a problem in a six-year-old who has a palpebral fissure of 2.3 versus 2.4, and there's absolutely no question about that, but we've been dealing with that now ever since we've been doing this. So, we don't use the chart in Hall. We thought we were using the Thomas chart, but we don't use the Thomas chart. We use this chart 13 that was created as I'm sure that was adapted from the Thomas chart, and that's the chart that we've been using forever. So it seems to me that to develop a new palpebral fissure chart in 2010 would be in the middle of this study would be absolutely. It would be suicide. Crazy.
Well,
I think we just. I just. Think
well, then I think
to use what we're using.
Well, then I think
chart 13.
Well, I think you need then to either find out where in reality chart 13 is.
You mean where it came from?
No, but where what it really stands for. If it's the 10th centile. Is really chart 13's 15th percentile, we should know that.
Well, that you're right. That would mean doing completely new charts.
I'm not saying that we scrap whatever what we have, but what I'm saying is that for at least trying to do this 3D imaging, it's very difficult.
Well, I think the 3D imaging people should use chart 13 as opposed to the Thomas chart.
Well, I think they have been, but that's one thing we need to clarify because everyone thought the Thomas chart and 13 were the same.
Right, and you have through very excellent detective work demonstrated that we're completely wrong about that, and I think it was just a. Error that somebody made that adapted chart 13 from the Thomas chart. I'll just tell you that when Elsevier put the Thomas chart in my book for the normal palpebral fissure size, I was extremely upset at them because I had wanted them to put chart 13 in because it's so much easier to read. But obviously they were right to do that.
No, I'm not sure they were because I think the problem with the Thomas one is it really wasn't based on any data they ever collected.
No, you're right, it wasn't.
And so that their chart, as originally published, may have been what they thought they had, but they did it mainly through an algorithm. And that algorithm may be changed, and chart 13 could be the right one. I don't think anyone knows. And
so you're saying that maybe taking the data that I published on babies and
right.
taking Chock's paper in which she got it from birth up through 14 years of age, maybe that's chart 13, not the Thomas chart.
Right.
Well, that's interesting. We should be able to figure that out.
Well, we should be able to. I personally think it's chart 13 that someone just put an extra or didn't use enough decimal points.
That's what I think.
Because the R values were transformed was function was 0.898. And if you would have just transformed using 0.89, you would lower the older kids down, and that's what chart 13 is. It's slightly different in the older ages.
Well, that's what, that's you're right then. That's got to be what happened.
So I don't think it was any, you know, that people were trying to screw this up, but
no, I don't either.
It somehow got done, and so. But I
well,
think
can I ask a kind of a silly question? If everyone aren't we in within the consortium? I understand, Ed, your concern about different people using different charts, but aren't we all using the same chart in within the consortium?
Well,
shouldn't there be consistency from at least within our consortium?
But that's what we need to find out from Tatiana, whether they're using the Thomas chart or the chart 13.
We're using chart 13.
Okay, so everybody's using the same. Unless some dysmorphologist somewhere is carrying around the Thomas chart, thinking that they're using that's the same as chart 13.
Right.
Now,
but
all our
same person sees the same chart. Two people see the same child and use the same chart. Assuming they get a similar measurement, they should come up with a similar outcome.
Yes.
Okay. And just in answer to your question, there are 520 kids in the consortium that are designated as controls who have palpebral fissure measurements.
Ed, it's Michael. Let me ask a question. Are we creating a database of our own of measurements that could produce a new chart? Concerned about the old charts?
Yeah, we do. I think, you know, and these charts are based on ridiculously low numbers.
Well, that's why. That's what I mean, there's over 500 kids that we have who are not exposed, or at least they're designated as controls. Who
are
have
you sure those are all unique?
I'm not 100% certain, but I searched for primary record, so they should be mostly, I would say at least 90% of them are unique, so, you know, 480 kids.
Well, I just brought this up as food for thought about, you know, what really, because I was concerned about the 3D imaging measurements not always corresponding real well with some of the, you know, the dysmorphology. And the more I've read about palpebral fissure size, they're almost impossible to measure anyway. If your eye is slightly looking down, that could change it by a millimeter and a half, which that's over one standard deviation difference.
What do you mean looking down? You mean if they have epicanthic folds?
No, if they just gaze downward while they're doing it.
We've standardized that.
Yeah, I know. But if when you do it in the picture, sometimes the eyes are not looking up, same when the exam goes on.
Well, there's one of the biggest issues. You've got two completely different paradigms. You've got a 2D and a 3D picture paradigm, and they're different among themselves, but both of those are different from the live physical measurement in the clinical realm.
Yeah. I'd almost be willing to assume that there'd be better interreliability between the 3D camera and the 3D camera taken a second time than,
sure, yeah, I would think so too.
But it's just food for thought because, you know, Tatiana and Lee are faced with this problem of trying to find out how good the 3D camera is. And if they, I mean, Leah, maybe you can describe your problem issue better. I mean.
Well, some of our misclassifications come from our palpebral fissure length being a little bit larger. So they don't make the 10th percentile cutoff.
You mean on the camera, on the
camera.
Photo? Your pictures on the camera are consistently larger than our measurement.
Well, that's a good question because it depends on which dysmorphologist we compare to and if Sophia does the measurement or if Elizabeth does the measurement. Everyone's correlated, but sometimes one of them is slightly larger than the other one, although consistently larger.
Right.
I mean, so maybe we need 10th centile plus or minus, you know.
something or other. On the camera measurements, I don't know. But I just brought that up as food for thought. The second issue, and this is one that people are going to have to... Ken and Leah Pruitt and I had a nice conversation, and within the Discord core, basically Ken has Leah...
Leela,
I'm sorry. I got a Leah on the phone and a Leela in my head. And so she has provided me with basically what she has to do once some dysmorphology exam is done. And she has this paper form that she gets from Ken or one of the other dysmorphologists. And she is spending an inordinate amount of time correcting things and recalculating from getting the right birthday in for the child and to the right percentile, recalculating height and weight percentiles, replotting head circumference. And so she is doing a lot more than was originally described in time-wise in the grant application. And so we need to figure out some way to relieve her of some of this, which is really unfortunate that there's so much error correction and checking that has to go on for this. And so I would like to hear anyone's suggestions, but primarily informatics core, and we don't need to do it on the phone call, but if they could put their heads together and come up with some way to try to get the data from the data paper sheet, if that, or from the measurements that this morphologist is taking into the central repository without having to go through all these additional steps, that I think would be a great help. Ken, you have any other comments on that?
No, I don't have any other comments, Ed.
Otherwise, I think
well articulated the issue.
I think we're going to have to get another person from somewhere in terms of at least getting some money to pay somebody to do some of this just checking and rechecking.
First of all, I think it has to be done. That's number one. And number two, we had sort of initially, I can remember the discussion that we had in a call like this, that we had made the decision, not we, you had made the decision, I think it was you, that every site was going to have a data entry person who was going to be doing this. And that never happened. And so one person, Leela, is doing all this. So it seems to me the alternatives to having Leela spend so much time is having a data person hired at each site or doing something through the central repository that deals with this.
Well, I think the data person at each site doesn't work because there's just not enough dysmorphology data being collected at any site.
Okay. All right.
So I think having, a one type, one place, and whether that be here, your place, or in the informatics core, I don't know. But
okay.
That's why I would just kind of like people to think about and ways to reduce the time that's required to do these required checks. I mean, I know you need checks and balances and rechecking the data, but when you read through what she does on each record, it's, that people can't get the right birthday put in on the exam, and that people are still doing it in inches and rather than in centimeters. All that then has to be converted. So I think we need to – I'll send this to the informatics people And maybe they can think of a way to, you know, limit the fields or maybe go back to thinking about the automated input from the computer, the touchpad or the stylus-type computer, and not allowing the dysmorphologist to add in metric units when they really want, or not, where inches wouldn't compute on the computer, wouldn't let you add the height in inches. It would make you do it in the metric form.
I don't know that this is important for you to be aware of, Ed, but the dysmorphologist does not put in the height, weight, and head circumference measurement.
Well, someone said that.
Exactly.
In each site,
that is done before the dysmorphologist sees the subject, the child. I'm not going to say subject anymore.
All right. But so there's just got to be a way to beat into these people that they're taking a shortcut is costing us in the long run at the end. Because then Leela has to go back and correct every one of those ones that's in the wrong format. And her time's too valuable to do that. So,
Ed, this is Bill Barnett. I think there's a lot to what you say there in terms of just making sure that the workflow is right and the data are being entered right, and we can certainly help out in looking at those workflows and making sure that the data are recorded correctly and helping with some of those tools. But in essence, it's kind of like one of those garbage in, garbage out things. If the data aren't being recorded correctly, there's not a lot we can help with the tools to improve that, but we can't make the data good if they're not good.
No, but I mean, what I was thinking of is that you have limits, so that if someone's 60 inches tall and they're putting in 60 inches and the form wants metric,
yeah,
that's not allowed because, you know, 60 is not it's an unrealistic number for someone who's 15, 16 years old.
Right.
That exists on the actual data. When you go to enter it in the computer, that exists. So that mechanism is already there. There's a range for each, an allowable range for each variable.
Well,
but on the paper, that doesn't exist because it's paper.
Right. That's what I was referring to, was the paper forms.
Why doesn't each site designate a rechecker for the dysmorphology form and just change to metric if something gets recorded in inches?
Well, that's what I want people to do. I want people to think about it, and I can send this, what goes into the dysmorphology exams being uploaded into the central repository, what happens beforehand to each of the sites, to each of the PIs. And then if people could brainstorm ways to improve this, that would be great.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense from our side.
All right, because, I mean, it's just taking way too long. And you know, she claims that just doing this takes one quarter to one full-time equivalent person per week, depending upon the number of exams that come in. And, you know, I think what according to the Michelle's calculation, they had, 20-something new exams this month. So it's just taking an incredibly long time. So I will send that out, and then if people have ways that we can resolve it, hopefully that will work. Let's see. Yeah, there were 21 dysmorphology exams put in this month, in May. And if it's taking that much time for those 21 exams, you know, it's just, she has better things to do. So.
Well, I think the other thing to remember is that it's hugely time-consuming, all of this data, and, you know, getting it ready to put into the repository.
Oh, I agree. And if there was lots and lots and lots of data being collected, I would be very, very concerned. But, you know, that's not the case right now. You know, there are three subjects a month per site on average on this last list that I'm getting right here. It's for dysmorphology exams. Yeah,
Elizabeth Sal, Los Angeles, had 14 cases. Phil May in South Africa had 4. And Sarah Matz in San Diego had 3. And neurobehavioral, there was 27 subjects collected at each site and for the entire month, or at all sites total for the entire month. So I think we can get 27 data or subjects entered into the database without having to go through lots of craziness. All right, well, that's my for that.
Ed, can I ask a question, though? We haven't resolved what we should do with the...
I'm losing you.
Can't hear you, Sarah.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. We haven't resolved what we can do, what we do with the errors that need to be corrected in the central repository.
In any database or in the dysmorphology database?
In dysmorphology database.
Until I would just record them right now because we have to figure out a way to when someone notices that there is an error.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I would just get it to Andy and have.
But we can't change it. That's the issue, and that's I think what brought on part of this discussion is that Andy or somebody can change it at the level of the central repository. But if it doesn't get changed at the local level, it will be overwritten the next time an upload happens.
No, I think that once Andy corrects it, then he needs to let you know to correct it at the local level.
But it's not me. It's Leela that has the local database. Otherwise, we would do it. We would do the whole thing, but we can't.
Why are successive uploads overwriting?
That I don't know the answer to.
That doesn't seem to be... I mean, I don't know why that would be that way. Andy would know that.
Or Michelle.
But I think it allowed her to make the corrections and then not have to worry about correcting them in the original database.
Yes.
But I don't know. That's my guess.
I mean, so right. We find an error in our local database in Neuro, we just change it and re-upload and it fixes it. At the central
All right,
level.
But it's not going in the other direction, and that's Ed's
right.
point.
Right.
How would Central know that there's an error?
We'd have to tell them. You mean in dysmorphology?
In anything.
Or in anything? They wouldn't know. Like in Neuro, if we find an error, we fix it, and it gets uploaded and it's corrected.
So I'm not sure what the problem is. How would Central identify an issue, Ed, an error?
They'd have to be told.
They're told, for example, if a birth date doesn't make sense between the neurobehavioral and the dysmorphology database, then someone has to check and find out why the same kid has two different birth dates. One of them has to be wrong, and then that one's corrected. And if it's in the dysmorphology database, it used to be done at UCSD and then re-uploaded to the central repository. But now we can't do that anymore because of the time commitment that Leela has.
Okay.
So we're going to have to figure out a way that here for the neurobehavioral, Sarah's acting like Leela does for the dysmorphology. So it's, I think, transparent to the informatics core. They don't see the changes that are being made. It just happens in the database. But we're going to have to figure out some system. So people think about it, read through what has to be done in the dysmorphology, then charge of that. All right, I want to get on to some of the updates. We have the symposium coming up at RSA at the end of the month. So some of these answers to the questions may help out. Now, so there are 5 questions. And, Ken, I'm assuming that you haven't gotten any more classic FAS kits to deal with, so question 1 is still on hold?
On hold, yeah.
All right. Sarah, you got question 2?
Yes. So we have been working with the data from the frozen database. We've analyzed it in several different ways, and our classification rates vary depending on whether we include only FAS or whether we include all alcohol exposed versus controls and so on. And they're, in some cases, very good. They're just not as good as our last. I think we were doomed by our outstanding classification last time, if that makes sense. We had such a high classification rate last time. But one thing I can tell you is that when we rerun, so last time using phase one, we identified a certain number of a certain set of variables, and if we use those same variables or the ones we have available now, we can classify 82% correctly, which is not as good as we did last time.
Of all,
but it's still, I have to say, if we had 82% last time, we would have been thrilled. But it was better last time,
but
and so 82% is still good. It's just it's very good.
Those kids are just FAS.
That was just FAS. Unfortunately, we can't rerun. With all subjects, it goes to 77%. We can't rerun it. There's one of them that we can't rerun with just the non-FAS subjects because we don't have enough. And the program won't allow. It's not. There's no solution because there's not enough subjects. So one of the things that I've been considering is whether we should. We now have 100 more subjects in the database than when the database was frozen. I don't know that those subjects are complete. And we did spend a lot of time, you know, doing cleaning and fixing the database. The frozen database. And so on one hand, I don't really want to enter into that again, but it is 100 more subjects.
Right.
And that would be a big plus.
The question I have is that was, what was the difference between phase one and phase two? Is that behavioral tests in phase two were chosen based upon the best test in phase one, presumably? Why do you think that the... is less now than it was when we used the broader?
Well, what we did was so the tests that were the best in phase one were predominantly executive functioning measures, and so we focused mostly on executive functioning this time around. And it may be that there's more variability in our sample this time, and that's what's causing it. Obviously our data collection is still in progress. It would be great if we could have more subjects. That variability.
Do you have any idea why you think it'd be more variable this time than in phase?
I have a suggestion. How about if you used on the current data set, the second data set, a different type of analysis?
We have considered that. We also ran. We have considered doing that. We also ran. The same type of analysis, but with different variables, and using that, we can classify. See if I get this right. 70% of the subjects overall, 77% of the FAS subjects, with a different set of variables. So we're still hovering around, you know, this 75% to 80%. But yeah, we've considered looking at other types of analyses.
Yeah, doing some factor analysis and then feeding them into a stepwise regression or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the statistician that we're working with is partial to this analysis, and it does work with the type of analysis we're doing, but it's definitely an option.
Well, it'll be interesting to hear your conclusions at the RSA.
I know. Won't it be?
Yes, it will. All right, Leah.
But wait, my question is, should we pursue expanding the data set?
I think what I'm interested in are the answers. And if it takes expanding the data set to do that, then I'd say yes.
Okay. I'll look into it. I mean, it may be that there's 100 new subjects, but they're not complete, and then it's not worth us going in and trying to... do all the fixing that took us several weeks to do that. I think ultimately we will definitely add more subjects because, I mean, we're collecting them and we don't want to waste them. We want to use every possible subject. Whether we can do that for RSA is another question.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the the important thing is to try to identify a group of behavioral tests that measures or can identify heavily alcoholic associates.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, I mean, I have to say, in my defense, of course, that 77% classification is really good. It's just not as good as it was the first time.
Well, I think 77 is okay, but if that's with, well, that's all kids. And
that's all kids.
I mean, I don't know what the classification rate alone on IQ would be.
Right.
So, I mean, it.
And last time we were able to do better than IQ. I don't know. I don't have that right here.
But when you give a six-hour neuropsych battery, you expect to do better than when you're just assessing on one variable.
Right.
So, you know, the smallest number of tests that helps define that.
Right.
And it may be that there are more than one profile in alcohol-exposed kids. And, you know, I've said for a while that, you know, I think profiles vary as a function of IQ.
Right.
And if we just group everybody in as one lump, then you're just going to get a lot of, you know, extraneous variability. So, you know, I think all of that has to try to come out in the wash. But
yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, we could break it down, you know, even into just two IQ groups. I think the problem that we will have is controls, you know, which controls do we compare them to, and then whether we'll have...
We got about 20 minutes, so I want to move along.
Okay.
All right, because I know that Leah has some stuff she wants to talk about with the camera and the... So, Leah, you're on.
What do you want me to talk about first, our results or the Australian sample?
Well, within the context of your question.
The question, we
find
did very...
morphology algorithm for diagnosing FASD to determine if the 3D data can be used to diagnose FASD in a similar clinically relevant manner with the dysmorphologist.
When we use the same algorithm that the dysmorphology core is using.
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing.
Is this better?
Yes, thank you.
When we use the same algorithm that the dysmorphology core uses, we get about 61% correct classification of the FAS kids and 87% of the controls. So we don't do that great. But if we use facial measurements from the camera, we get about 78% correct classification. So we get about the same as surrogates, and we also got a much better classification rate with the first phase data.
Leah, I think 78% is excellent.
So then I think that if I'm hearing you correctly, once Peter Hammond gets the data, it may even go up because he's going to be looking at lots of of these facial measurements and their relationships to each other.
Right.
All right. And we have a conference call with him next Tuesday.
Yes.
All right.
Although now he's working with South African data because there are only 18 FAS kids with a 3D image from the U.S. That's not enough for him to work with.
So in our database of U.S. kids, there's 18 FAS kids?
With a 3D image.
Boy, with rates of 5 per 1,000, you would think we'd be able to find more than 15 kids.
Will be nice.
Okay.
Now, but now, wait a second. That's 15 kids with fetal alcohol syndrome who have had facial imaging.
Right.
Right, but everyone in the States should have had a facial image.
Well, have they?
No, not at all.
Not Phil May's cohort.
Well, no.
Exactly.
Phil's not doing 3D imaging.
Right.
Right.
And
but,
I have all those of FAS kids in the States.
But all of the, between San Diego, Los Angeles, and Atlanta, all right, three big cities, we've managed to get three FAS cases?
18.
18. All right.
But don't we have more than that in the three cities?
No.
Really?
Ed, I'm looking at the charts, and I'm seeing bigger numbers. Is that because their controls being imaged amongst them?
No, I think the difference is between we get a lot of AR&D kits, but not a lot of the FAS, the classic FAS cases.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thank you.
And we're low on the FAS cases.
Right.
All right. Tatiana, I don't want to cut you off, but is there any important data that you'd like to report to us?
You mean me?
I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, Leah.
No, that's the biggest for our question, and then the Australian people will start seeing subjects. They want us to bring the camera next summer, and they'll have about 140 kids ages 7 to 8. They expect about 20% to be exposed and maybe 10% to have full-blown FAS. And Sandy Jacobson.
Yeah, for people who don't know about this, Elizabeth Elliott, who's an Australian researcher, is interested in studying an Aboriginal population, and they've want to use the 3D camera, and they may want to use some of the other methodology that we've been using in CFAS. And that conversation has just begun. All right, I'm sorry, Leah.
No, that's right. Basically it.
All right, Phil, you want to fill us in?
About what? About neuro?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm skipping around. The questions, Elizabeth's not on the phone, so we can't talk about her question. Sarah, you have question 5.
Okay, question 5. Well, we had set a deadline for the end of the month for identifying our variables. We have most of them. We have the brain variables and the brain data. We have the facial variables and the neural variables. Ken's going to send the dysmorphology variables tomorrow when he gets back from Chicago, pending thunderstorms. So we're hoping then that we can easily extract the data from the central repository and start analyzing.
All righty. Okay, so we haven't heard from Phil. You want to fill us in on, I know that you've been collecting data.
We've been up in the plains. We did 2 solid weeks. We have done 30 additional batteries in the plains. We have staff working on uploading now, coordinating with Sarah, and we've opted to take Sarah up on the uploading from San Diego because of increased manpower there on the WISC. And what other things?
We have a scoring software issue.
On the WISC and what other?
In Vineland.
And so anyway, they're being uploaded. We have another trip to the plains planned on the 21st, and we'll do another week up there. New Mexico has been a big zero, and was Dan Savage was to call you, Ed, did he?
No.
Okay. I really don't want to get into it without, with the whole group here, but it's been a complete concrete wall here. So what we are doing, since we cannot get anything out of the UNM system or any of its ancillary kids, we are out in working in community groups to get referrals of ADHD and FASD kids because we already have substantial controls. And we just got approved a flyer and a newspaper ad from the IRB, and that's going out in a lot of different sources. So we'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks regarding the New Mexico site.
Okay.
There are huge political issues, and it involves a couple of your other projects, too, about this referral roadblock that we have.
Yeah,
Claudia, I asked Dan to call you and give you his caught-in-the-middle position, which may be more objective than mine, but Wendy and I did everything we could to accommodate a number of other agencies and people here. And we have gotten nothing but our hands slapped. So,
when I talk to them, I'll let you know. Tina, are you on?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. So let's see. We are
just got another large blood shipment from Ukraine. So Carl and Jan are in the process of analyzing that. And Leela just finished doing all of the conversions of the measurements from the big batch of ultrasound data that we got. So we're looking forward to doing the analysis of that. Ken's going to be there next week, end of next week, to do validation of physical exams in the two sites. And we are awaiting, talked with Leah and Jeff about processing the images from the 3D camera. They'd like to get some feedback on what happened with the 30 or so images they've already done before going through the process of re-importing the camera to do new kids and re-image other kids.
We've actually got them processed, and
good.
He is now looking at the 3D images.
Great.
Something to give you some feedback.
Okay.
All right.
We turned in an R21 application for Fogarty to try to continue to get funding to follow the cohort.
That's good. All right, informatics. Any news there that we need to know about?
I don't think so. I think we're all set. We're taking data in and.
Right.
And trying to support you guys as you're tackling your five questions.
Okay. Is Claudia on? Okay. Well, and Elizabeth Sal, did anyone from UCLA come on? Okay. All right, well, that's it. And
can I add something, Ed, just from the general neuro?
Yeah.
A couple things. One is that one thing that Phil mentioned was that we have put out the offer to, in trying to get data into the database more quickly, that the sites can send us their files and we will recheck them and enter them and upload them, which normally is done at the site, but we've offered to do that for the summer because we have some ERA students, ERA-supported students who are helping us. And Phil, as Phil mentioned, he's going to do that. So we're thrilled to help with that. And then one thing informatics didn't mention is that they've been helping us with this, trying to institute the grouping variable into the neuro database, which is a huge plus for us.
Okay. In terms of the neurobehavioral project, there are some sites that are still lagging behind in getting data into the central repository and getting their demographic data uploaded. So I want to urge everyone to get those and work on those because without complete data sets, there's not some of the things we just can't do. Does anyone know how many total saliva samples we have? This came up on the basic science call, and I said I would ask. Leah,
it's on the chart. It's on the Google chart.
It's in the Google chart.
Oh, all right.
It's on the facial imaging chart, I think. Maybe. Yeah, DNA samples total 211.
We don't know how that's broken down, do we?
Yeah, we do. 70 FASD, 63 control, 3 low IQ, 18 ADHD, 57 unknowns for a total of 211.
Okay, great. That's what I needed to know. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's on the, if you want it, it's on the 3D camera page, and it's at the bottom, so it's easy to miss.
Okay, I'll find it. All right. NIAAA staff have anything that they would like to tell us, inform us about, berate us about?
I've got nothing of that nature, but I'm looking forward to RSA and seeing many of you in the symposium.
Well, I'm interested in this symposium as well as the one that's going to happen in ISBRA. I don't know if Michael's not on or we would thank.
No, I'm on.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Hi. I even asked a question earlier.
Oh, my God. What was I doing? I thought it was John who asked that question.
Oh. No, but you answered it politely, and so I was very grateful.
Oh, okay. Well, then, as scientific director, what would you like to tell the group?
We're going to have a nice symposium at RSA, and everybody should come.
I'm going to try to get everybody there. And for the ISBRA one,
Have you heard anything negative about anyone not being there?
Not at all. At the moment, everybody is on.
All right, good, good.
Volcanoes and changes in the euro accepted.
Well, changes in the euro is a good thing. Except if you've already paid for your hotel.
Right.
It's not. All righty.
What's the Innsbruck thing?
The ISBRA. It's in Paris. It's the International Society for Biomedical Research on Alcohol. And there's a symposium with two basic science and two clinical talks, Michael?
It's going to be myself, Jennifer, Kathy Sulik, and Andre Urbanek doing an imaging human thing. So a sort of progression from molecular to animal to imaging in animals to imaging in humans.
So that'll be in September.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit more about this Australian thing?
I don't know very much about it other than Elizabeth contacted Tatiana about the 3D imaging, and they wanted to get a camera there and asked if this could perhaps be that what methodologies we were using, because they would like to, if they do behavioral assessments, is to do the same types of behavioral tests. So that's about it. I have not spoken directly with Elizabeth about it. So that's about all I can tell you, Ken, because I know you've been there. You've been there.
Yep.
You've talked to them. So, I didn't even know that Tatiana had talked to them again about setting up when the camera would go there. So.
Okay.
All righty. Well, everyone have a wonderful weekend, and we will see most of you in San Antonio.
Sounds good.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.